A serpent's key.
From a lawyer's point of view, there is a religious liberties defense that could be used because we, you know, divination is an integral part of all Euro-Indigenous faith traditions, whether you're a witch or a heathen or a pagan.
Imagine yourself under a starry sky, around the warm glow of a sacred fire, where speakers gather to share their wisdom and insights. Creating a sacred space where all are welcome to warm their hands, here are your hosts, Caitlin Stormbreaker, Sarinth Odinson, and Jim Two Sneaks, discuss spirituality, mythology, animism, and culture around a virtual sacred fire.
Welcome.
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 Welcome. Won't you join us around Grandfather Fire?
Now the dark nights come. Now the dark time settles over the land. We gather around our fires close, pull over warm blankets, bring warm mugs to our lips. We feel the promise of winter in the air. We hear the rattles, the movements, the shifting of hoofbeats on the wind just out of reach, just out of sight. We hear, we see, we feel, we smell all the times of winter, all the little moments of winter starting to creep our way in this in-between and betwixt time, where some say the veil is thin, but the truth is, veils are thin anyway. Were you really that protected? Don't be afraid to turn your clothes inside out. Don't be afraid to walk the dark places if that's where your feet are guiding you. Because darkness is on the land. The harvest is coming in. And so are we. To our homes, to our hearths, to warmth and family, to good soups, to warm breads. Where we gather around in these last days of summer, as we watch the fires die outside, bring the fire in. Gather close, close with your family and your loved ones, your gods, your ancestors, and your Vaitir. All the holy ones who share our homes, the house spirits, the house gods, the little fuzzy beings that call our place home, whether we want them in or not. Hail to all you beautiful, cold and warm, dark and light, betwixt and between shining ones, dark ones. Hail to you, the coming of the winter, the present of the fall. Hail to you, home and hearth and family, all the blessings of community. Be with each and every one of us as the dark time comes around again. Hail to you all. Hail to you all. Hail to you all. Esluhail.
You're listening to another episode of Around Grandfather Fire, episode 119. I'm your host, Jim Two Snakes, joined as always by my good friends and co-hosts, Caitlin Stormbreaker and Sarinth Odinson. And this time, I'd like to do it a little bit different. Our guest tonight is the author of the Witch's Wisdom Tarot and the book Spells for Living Well. And as a multiple time returning guest, feels more like one of the gang. So we're going to go right from the beginning here. How's everybody doing tonight? How are you doing tonight, Phyllis?
I'm doing really good. I'm dazzled by the passage of time. I'm celebrating the 25th anniversary of Book of Shadows.
Really? Yay! And it's the anniversary for Spells for Living Well as well, isn't it?
No, that just came out earlier this year. But
was it this year? I was thinking I had an email from it.
That's okay. The big one. But well, the tarot is right now, and it's about to come out in a new, small, less expensive, for some easier to handle because the cards will be smaller. A new edition. They're going to put it out at the end of the month. So that's exciting.
That is cool.
We've been like, whoa, 25 years? 25 years? There are people who are witches who are not, you know, who are like, that was when they were born.
I know it, right?
Okay. It's interesting. Yeah. So, yeah, time.
It slips right on by.
Yeah, it disappears like the summer goes by in the goes by in the blink. But yeah, all things are good. All things are good. I'm filled with gratitude. I'm working as hard as I can, as fast as I can. And
you are always busy, that's for sure.
I am. We did the Parliament of the World's Religions in Chicago. Right. August. Yeah, we had a lot of pagans. It was wonderful. And lots
Excellent.
Of ritual and pagan presentations and just people there and old guard, new guard, people who'd never been there before. It was lovely. And we had about 7,500 folks. So it was a success. And the theme was, my theme, I persuaded the board we should do it. And I'm glad that we did. It was a call to conscience, defending freedom and human rights and democracy. And we had a lot of very fine speakers, activists, religious leaders, spiritual leaders. Got messages from Nancy Pelosi and Raphael Warnock.
Oh, and wow.
Folks. And
wow.
You know, I would rather have had 50,000 people, you know, in the streets making a ruckus. But there were enough people there. landed. And there was good press in all the major dailies. The AP covered it. And so it made all the major dailies. It was in the Washington Post and we were on NPR, All Things Considered. And I gave two talks that I was very proud of. And I learned that nodding one's head is not the equivalent of emoting. When you're filling a giant stadium, you need to, you know, emote. So I learned. I was proud of it. And it's an interesting thing to stand in front of thousands of people and say, you know, and begin a talk by saying, I'm a witch. Even though I've been doing it for more than 40 years, and I've certainly done it in the context of the Parliament for 30 years, it still brings a shiver. You know, there is still the remnant of the witch trauma. Right. And it is more activated right now because there's a reason for us to be, all of us to be exceedingly worried about what's happening, about this rapid ascendance of authoritarianism.
Which yeah, exactly.
Conference. Exactly. I can just imagine the tears of the prosecuted witches in the past, the ones that had to hide and cower and sequester their practices to hear the words that you said in front of that many people and square your shoulders and straighten your back and profess, I'm a witch.
Yeah.
And I can only imagine the amount of healing that has done for them. In just a simple statement in front of so many people.
Yeah. Well, the point of beginning with that was to say, I know what persecution feels like, right? And in my bones, it's in my bones. It's in my genes. My mother is Jewish. So that is a part of my ancestral memory. And my faith is still a persecuted faith.
Oh, yeah.
And was a brutally persecuted faith for hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. And so, so I understand what it means to be the other. And that was the talk, was that one of the strategies that fascists use is always to pick out the scapegoat, to pick out the minority, to pick out the group that will be the target towards which the rage, the id, the dark energies, right? The fear and that, I don't know what that is in us, that unresolved reptile brain direct away from the sources of true oppression towards those who are in fact oppressed. And so that's, if anything, if any, you know, and the persecution has always used religions, and it's happening right now where they will misappropriate a religion to legitimize their power. Like in Hungary, you know, who's like defending Christianity, which is bullshit, and suddenly Putin is like kneeling at the altar in the Russian Orthodox Church. I mean, who's he kidding, right?
Well, I don't know. I guess did you all see that the updated list of terrorist air quotes their symbols came out, and they included all kinds of Antifa symbols and slogans. And I mean, if you're anti-fascist now, then you're apparently a terrorist. And, you know, as far as the persecution goes on TikTok, there was a small shop in Pennsylvania whose owner was posting just this earlier this week. I don't remember the name of the shop. Let me put it in the show notes, but they had a visit because someone had complained about their sign about offering tarot readings. And so the chief of police came into the store to gently remind them of what the laws about fortune telling are. And it's like, yeah, okay, are you going to go warn the Baptist church about, you know, something that they're doing? Are you going to? No, you're not. All these double standards. You know exactly what you're doing.
Yeah. It's
a serpent's key. Is the
Serpent's Key.
Their Serpent's Key shop and sanctuary, which is in Hanover, Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's from a lawyer's point of view, and I had an interesting conversation with a professor down in Atlanta who wanted to do a paper on it. I just didn't have time. But there is a religious liberties defense that could be used because divination is an integral part of all Euro-indigenous faith traditions, whether you're a witch or a heathen or a pagan, and whatever tool you use is secondary to the practice of divination as dialogue with the divine. The Christians let the Bible fall open and read the passage, right? Bibliomancy, whatever. So she's got to, if they pursue a persecution of her, it would be an interesting lawsuit and you can't guarantee that she'd win, but there's a strong basis upon which a case could be made.
Well, I'm wondering, I'm like, did they go down and insist that the publisher of the local paper gets arrested for having the astrology in the paper?
Exactly. Exactly. There are always these, and that is not a religious practice, right?
That's, exactly.
They would call it entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's part of why on my site, when I put up the, services page, I explain these are not for entertainment. This is not for, you know, anything like that. This is a spiritual pursuit because a lot of the laws as written, from what I understand, are premised on fraud.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so they'll insist like it can only be for entertainment purposes. Okay. But if I am providing a genuine spiritual service, you know, that's also protecting.
I mean, I can understand where they're coming from to a degree. When those laws were written, you know, there was probably genuine concern about people defrauding people by using fake practices. But like, I'm sorry, we've got several pastors and priests that are flying around private jets. I think they're bilking people too. Sorry.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When they start going after mega churches, then.
Exactly. Then I'll take them seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, the Peter Popoff Ministries, I'm still seeing their advertisements for their miracle water.
Mm-hmm.
And they bill that as being able to resolve your financial and medical issues. So, like, I don't know how they get away with running these ads even at 3 a.m. anymore.
Yeah.
But anyway, really quick, because we kind of, how are you two doing?
Not too bad. I've just been working on advancing some career stuff. So that's been, most of my spare time's gone towards taking some online classes lately. I was just made a district steward in my union.
Yay.
And I know it. Solidarity forever.
And, solidarity forever. Hell yeah.
And, you know, just keeping busy around the house, you know, putting my head down, trying to get some projects done before winter hits. So how about you, Kaylin?
I'm here. like I was telling you guys Before we started recording, I'm coming off of a rather heavy ritual that I helped a friend complete yesterday. And I am just now starting to feel vaguely human, but I'm very, very exhausted. So you don't hear me talking very much tonight. That is why. But besides that, you know, we have the whole stress with the UAW strike going on.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Now. A lot of people know my husband works for Ford, and we're going on the third week, I believe, that they're on strike.
Yep.
And it's a lot of malarkey from the companies, and so it's a lot of stress. And the next week we're driving to Texas for a wedding, so like, cool, an added expense that I need.
Although I did see today from the UAW president that the General Motors has agreed to put their electric battery-powered car plans under the collective bargaining agreement, which is something that they said they would never do. So they are bending.
They are bending. And I don't want to speak on my own theories of why they are doing that for sake of animosity and stuff like that. But they are slowly yet surely having the pressure being put on them, because every day, I think somebody added it up, but every day that the plant my husband works at is closed, they lose like $1 billion or something close to that. Like it's a ridiculous amount of money that they lose. It might not be quite that much, but it is. I mean, the vehicles he makes are very, very popular. So they are. And I really like the president of the UAW right now because of the way he's handling the whole situation. And he's being very firm and very reasonable with these billionaires, saying, you don't understand that you have hundreds, if not thousands, of workers that have multiple jobs while working at your company.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. There was one guy that Matt repped on night shift that had three jobs while also working 40 plus hours at Ford.
Oh, hell no.
Oh, wow.
They made a lot of concessions years back. They made a lot of concessions.
They did.
People are like, oh, yeah, I wanted so much money, but they made a lot of concessions. So they're trying to recoup what.
Yeah. So, well, back in 2012, when the other two, Chrysler and GM, went bankrupt or filed for bankruptcy, Ford never did because their employees agreed to give up many things to keep the company afloat with the agreement that they would eventually get those things back. And now Ford is trying to say that, oh, we never agreed that you would get that back. And the writing was vague enough to where people are siding with Ford on that, but that's contract.
Yep.
You know,
it's interesting though to look at the change in attitudes towards labor and trade unions, because there was a real antipathy towards them. It really started in the 70s with all that. I mean, I'm really dating myself, but I remember, in part because of what happened with my dad, who was a brewer, but they were part of the Teamsters Union. And I was young, but you know, I was a union maid. I was raised with that song. So I always paid attention, and I became a union lawyer when I went into law school to be, a union lawyer. And the 70s was horrible. They kept blaming the trade unions on inflation.
Mm-hmm. You know?
Their fault. Right. Their requests for wages were the cause of inflation when it wasn't oil.
Mm-hmm. They're trying to use that same playbook again, I think.
Yeah, but there's a difference though in when they've taken polls now. Many, many, many more people in this country, despite the fact that only like 12% of Americans are in trade unions, the overall attitude towards unions is much more positive.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Support for unions is higher than it's been 40 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is great. Because, amazing.
Yeah, people are seeing the power of unions and how wonderful it is to have somebody fight the corporations for you, because without them, we wouldn't have weekends, we wouldn't have holidays, we wouldn't have safe working conditions, we wouldn't have, you know, a living wage, we wouldn't have these things that protect the people who create the things that we buy, you know, and that make these billionaires more billions every year. So it's a nice shift to see it. And I'm so happy that the Writers Guild, because I, you know, I'm an aspiring writer, they got a really good deal.
Yep.
because of their strike. And I'm really looking forward to the momentum that this ball that has started rolling is going to get, because they're hoping that it's going to go down to the foreign automaker plants, you know, down in Tennessee and Kentucky, you know, Toyota and Nissan and Hyundai, because that's what the big three are worried about. Yep. Is that they're like, oh, we won't be able to be competitive anymore if we give you all this stuff, because our car prices will have to go up. But really, they don't.
No.
What the Ford employees are asking for is 5% of the profits of which Ford currently makes. 5%.
Mm-hmm. And they have increased CEO salaries by an average of 40% in the last year, I believe.
I think it's the last 4 years, contract. Yeah. But yeah. Still, and that's all they're asking for is you got 40%, we get 40%.
Mm-hmm.
The average CEO in this country makes something like 400 times what the average worker makes.
And it's the only place that happens in the whole world. If you look at Volkswagen, the CEO there, I think he makes like $4 billion a year, whereas CEOs here make 21 to 30 billion a year.
You mean million?
Yes, I'm sorry, million. That's right.
Okay. I mean, I wouldn't doubt it at this point with our inflated costs of fuck all everything.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I misspoke. It was definitely, they make $4 million and then our CEOs make $21 million a year.
Yeah,
and
it's, well, some of the Nordic countries have the laws where the highest paid can only make so many times as much as the lowest paid. Man,
yeah. I am all for pay caps for rich fucks.
Yeah. Me too.
How people are doing in crappy work situations, though, Sarah. How are you? We didn't ask how you're doing yet.
Oh, well, just really quick before I forget. The other thing that I'm very excited for is the Writers Guild did authorize a strike for the Actors Guild, excuse me. SAG-AFTRA authorized a strike for video game companies.
Huh, makes sense.
What I remember. Awesome. And I'm very excited about that because companies like Blizzard and Activision, King, Ubisoft. And Ubisoft and all these other really like mega rich corporations have been getting away with screwing voice actors. Like some of your favorite voice actors from TV shows and video games, especially where they cross over a lot, like they get pennies on the dollar and they produce some of the most iconic acting work out there.
Yeah, and the video game industry makes more than the movie industry right now.
Yep.
Yeah. And the reason is because they don't show their face. They only use their voice. So they only have to pay them for their voice.
Right.
Whereas actors have both. If your face shows up and your voice is there, you get this amount.
Well, actually, the mocap stuff that they do now is skirts some of that, too. Yeah. That's how they get around some of that shit, too, is with their mocap suit work. Sorry, go ahead, John.
Well, and I was going to say the important part for the people that are making video games, as it was for a lot of the actors and stuff now, is the fact that once AI has enough of your image and voice, they don't need you anymore. Yep. So there's something in the contract in place that says, I'm sorry, if you're using my voice to generate this character, it doesn't matter if it's an AI replica of my voice, it's still my voice. I should still get paid. And that's a huge issue.
That is a huge issue. And if you don't think that AI is capable of doing something that is of what Jim is talking about, there is somebody on the internet, and I think it's called the AI guy, and I'm not sure, but he took the likeness of Joe Rogan, Donald Trump, Elon Musk, Gordon Ramsay, and a smattering of other celebrities, pumped it into an AI machine, and created a D&D campaign using Joe Rogan as the DM and put in a bunch of information about D&D. And he has like a 50 episode season right now. And we watched a few of them and it's like, these people are playing at the table. So like AI generated shit is genuinely very threatening.
There's a lot of videos that are doing music stars as well. You can take any old pop song and have it sung by Johnny Cash and all this other stuff now. And it's just, it's
scary.
It is. Cause
creative. It's scary.
I think as we talked about before, we thought that, you know, machines would do the mundane tasks and we would be creative. Instead, the capitalism's got it back ass. So
having the machines do all the creative stuff that we love to do and killing us on the machines. So
that's right.
How am I doing? I'm good. Overall, I worked a double yesterday. It was a very smooth one. I got a ton of writing done. I did about most of my first topic for the month for my Patreon is done, and I'm going to be working on the next one once that's said and done. I'm going to look at it with fresh eyes because, you know, after a while of working on it, eventually you start like, okay, I just want to just get this fucker written. So I'm going to give myself a couple hours of break, and then when I go back in tonight in between rounds or on break, I'm going to look at it and finish it up, post it. And I'm really happy that Malik gives me such challenging topics to write on, because it makes me exercise my brain, and it's produced amazing fodder for this book, which is now up to 50,000 words for the first draft. So Heathen Spirit Work is coming along. It's chugging along. It looks like my goal for having the first draft finished by the time December rolls around will be complete. I may have to actually be able to start editing it in December. We'll see.
That's really awesome. That's actually an interesting topic. Phyllis, as someone who's written and had a few books published, including one 25 years ago, any advice for like Caitlin or Sarah who are trying to wrap up a big, you know, manuscript book? How do you know when it's done? How do you put the finishing touches on it?
You run out of steam. The end.
I did it.
Or you have a deadline. You know, there's a contract and a deadline, and it's like, I have to stop now. I mean, I've always written to a deadline, and it's helpful because it keeps, you know, it keeps the spur to your side, so you keep working. Especially for me, it's very, very, very hard to start a book. That the beginning is the, once I'm in, I'm okay, but the beginning is just torment. So having a deadline helps, you know, it's like, you look at the watch. But the ending is, you've said everything you need to say, you know? And at a certain point, you know, you're beating a dead horse, to borrow a terrible metaphor. Then you have to shift gears. Because it's totally different, right? Between writing and editing. You're totally different headsets. With writing, you have to allow yourself complete freedom. You have to be very self-indulgent. You have to allow whatever comes. You have to overwrite. You can't censor yourself, and you can't edit yourself, because that just chokes off the creative flow. So you know, you have to let it go. And then when it's time to edit, you have to start killing your children.
Yeah, I believe they call it killing your darlings.
Yeah, it's like, oh, this is not a good thing. But it helps to have somebody else help you edit. It's a totally different mindset. It's the exact opposite.
I'm looking down the barrel at needing to. So some of this is about 30,000 words has been plucked out of my Patreon topic articles, so I have to figure out how to put this into the manuscript and whether or not it's appropriate for the, because I took a look, I stepped way back from the book and went, there ain't no fucking way with this outline that I'm going to be able to sit all this in one book. So I'm actually I had to, well, I mean, I was really at the start of this project, I wanted to shove it all in one book, and I'm like, this thing will be a tome you could kill somebody with. So I'm going to try and back this up into three books, because there ain't no way I'm going to cram this into one.
That's great. That's good.
Mm-hmm. So now I get to determine what Patreon articles go in this book versus the other two.
Yeah.
So that's, and I'm trying not to get ahead of myself on that, because I don't want to edit anything, and that would be editing it, until I'm done writing the words that I've got to write for this book. And it's like, I'm about 21,000 new words into this book already.
Great.
And I'm doing about 500 words every night, except for my days off. So
that's
wow. True.
You can need Tolkien, Tolkien himself only had a goal of 300 words a day, and often he would exceed those, but his goal was 300 words. And as long as he could sit down and get those out, then often he would write 1,000 or more. But some days it was only 300. So setting a low goal is a good thing. But what I've learned with editing is, not only does the project have to be complete before you start editing, but there are different types of editing that you have to get into the mindset of, and you can't do them all at once.
Ooh, that's a good point.
So you have like grammatical and line editing to go through and make sure all your I's are dotted and T's are crossed and you have the commas and periods and whatever, all in the right spot. But then you also have like flow editing and then voice editing and how the book is read. And then you also have, like in my case, because I write novels, it's a story continuity editing to make sure that I don't mention a mountain in a town and then in, you know, halfway through the book, suddenly the mountain's gone because I forgot about it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I've read many a manga where they forget plot details.
Yes.
And they either show up in really weird places because that was, you know, 3 years back, even though in book, it's like 2 months ago.
Right. Yeah.
Like Akira Toriyama is really good for forgetting entire power levels for his characters in Dragon Ball. It's like, wait, that was a thing? Oh, shit.
Oops. All right, I got to bring this back. Look, I have a dog in my story, and I constantly forget that it exists. So I have to go back every couple of, like, I'll be riding along, and
where's
I'm like,
dog? Oh, shit.
I got these four characters, and I'm like, buddy, no, I forgot him. So I have to go back and, like, type in just a few sentences so that when I go back and edit, I can give him, like, he's pivotal to the story. He has to be in there.
So you change him to a cat. If you have a cat, the cat will never let you forget.
When the cat's here 1 minute and gone the next, nobody thinks anything of it.
Fair. The cat will be in a different story, but this one needs a dog. So,
got you. It's also interesting to hear
What I was going to say, Sarah, is that your manuscripts, when you pull them together into one book, you just got to make sure that you have a gopher. And by that, I mean, have you ever seen the movie Caddyshack?
Yes.
When they were making Caddyshack, all the subplots and characters were so disconnected that when they were editing, they didn't have any idea how they were going to pull it together in a coherent story. And they realized that the gopher was the key to that. The gopher was essentially the through line to keep everything wove together.
Nice.
So taking all your various articles and saying these three go together where this one doesn't, and then I can change a little narration here and there to make sure they all connect together well. Seems like
that's actually not a bad idea. That's not a bad idea. And just thinking on like some of the books you've written, Phyllis, you know, when you've been working on your manuscript, like this manuscript has been in my head for about the last 4 or 5 years, and I've been fucking around with drafts and half measures up to this year when I finally sat down with my friend Deanna and said, all right, look, I want to actually get serious and get this fucker written. And she's like, okay, so give yourself a deadline, give yourself a word goal every day. And I was like, well, what about 1,000 words a night? And she looked at me like, are you out of your fucking mind? Yeah. I was like, okay, let's back it off. How about half of that? Okay, that's more reasonable. When you were writing Book of Shadows, what bug crawled up your ass to get that wrote? Because that's a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of work. And this hasn't left me alone for 4 or 5 fucking years now.
Well, the book that's my torment is the one that I'm supposed to be writing right now rather than teaching a
master. Okay, so this is never an issue you've ever had a resolution to. It's just something that you switch up with different books.
Yeah, the Book of Shadows was my first book, so Fools Rush In, where somebody who's now written, you know, a bunch of books is like, yeah, no. I didn't know what I was getting into, but I loved writing it. And I just, I loved it, and I had just a few years before, I was in film school. I had taken Robert McKee's story writing classes multiple times. He hadn't yet written his book, so that was in my head of how you do good story structure. Other than that, I really had no idea, you know, how to write a book. If I hadn't had his script writing class, I would have been a complete mess. But it was over 500 pages when I finished. I wrote it in about 9 months, but I worked on I worked on the plan for it, and that took about 6 months. And then I wrote it in 9 months, and it took about three to edit. And I had somebody help me because there was no way. Now I can edit my own stuff. I don't like to, but I can. And chopping it was very, very hard. I needed, you know, handholding. I needed them to tell me what they loved while they were telling me, like, oh God. that was easy to write. It was some of the happiest. I mean, I look back on it and remember, and I had a strategy was I had to be writing by 9 o'clock every morning. I mean, I was still practicing law, but I was able to do it. And I would write until one, take a half hour break, go back, write till 3:30. On Thursdays, I would drive into New York for my coven and drive back on Friday, try to take a little time off with my poor husband. And then, you know, write. And I was in it and I loved doing it. So it really just poured out. And it's multiple books. It's like, I mean, it was an insane thing to do because it has like three or four different voices. They're distinct styles because there are these interwoven stories of my work life and all the sexual harassment and the glamour and the bullshit. And then there was discovering the coven and all the magic that was happening in my personal life. And so I was writing like different styles because let's make it as complicated as we possibly can when we have no idea what we're doing, but it worked. Now I haven't read it in a couple of years and I didn't read it for a long time after it was out, and I read it and I was like, oh my God, that's terrible dialogue. You know, that's horrible dialogue. Why didn't somebody help you with that? And then I'll read another few pages on, and it was like, oh my God, that was so friggin' beautiful. I can't believe you wrote that. Wow. Like, I wrote that. It's fascinating. It's really interesting. I wish I could go back and edit it now. And I had a chance because the 20th anniversary edition, I self-published. And I could have rewritten it, but I resisted because you're not supposed to do that. So I didn't do it.
You don't want a George Lucas real material? Come on now.
But and the other challenge that I set out for myself was that I really felt like if you're a writer, you can't write the same book over and over and over again. You can't write the same writing style over and over and over again. If you're a writer, then you have to rise to the occasion and you have to challenge yourself and you have to write with a different voice and a different style. So each book, I mean, I have two memoirs and then I have two practice books. Then I have the spell book and I have the book for the deck, which is really written very different from any, you know, tarot books that I know of that accompany decks. It's visionary writing. And each one is a challenge, like to find the voice, to do it in the right way, to communicate, and not to ever, 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 ever write down to your reader. The thing that drives me batshit when I pick up books by people, you know, who are well-intentioned, but not well-trained or well-skilled, you know, and who are writing books that are being borrowed from lots of other people's books, is that they have a tendency to write down to the people who are reading it. And when I write, I want it to be accessible. I don't want it to be some intellectual abstract tome, you know, some academic thing, because I want it to reach as many people as possible. So I try to write in a very accessible, readable way, as if I'm talking to you, like I'm talking to you, right? But never down. So I have a tendency, you know, some my books can have complicated stuff in it or challenging ideas or things that are revolutionary, like years ago, like saying that the threefold law was bullshit and why, yeah. Or that, you know, mechanistic approaches to magic is, you know, also is nonsense. You know, it's a leftover of patriarchal thinking. So I'm always trying to advance the conversation. And I think I bring deep thinking to what I'm doing in a book, but I try to always do it in a way that is easy to read. you know, that's comfortable and easy and interesting and as if you were having a conversation with me.
Yeah, that's, go ahead, Storm.
I was just going to talk about how and it's probably a lot more difficult for you, Phyllis, and for you, Sarant, because of the focus of the books that you guys have written and are writing, versus what I'm doing as a novelist is to put in just enough information that the reader knows what you're trying to say, but not put in too much information that it's like you're walking them through the house and telling them, you know, like this painting is here and these are all the details on the painting. And then next to it is a door with this color door handle. And then like it, you got to let the reader kind of fill in some of the blanks themselves so that they create their own world with it. And I get a sense that that is what you were trying to do with your books, was give them enough information for them to be safe within their practice, but also a way to kind of make it their own and develop and grow from that point as well. And I can imagine how difficult trying to find where that line is, because it's very hard for me. And I often find myself having to pull back and be like, oh, you're giving too much information now, or you're not giving enough information, like this, it's too confusing. They don't know what this character is doing or who is even talking.
Yeah. It's a huge challenge. I mean, it's a huge challenge. And I think like anything, like any art, it helps to have skills and chops, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the only skills I had were screenwriting skills. Mm-hmm. And screenwriting skills are interesting because you don't have a lot of, you know, paintings on the wall or descriptions of what they're eating, or it's very spare in the mm-hmm. writing. So much of it is left up to other people to create.
And screenwriting is very character driven too.
Yeah. And it's completely dialogue driven. Right? Yeah. So yeah, I mean, when I wrote Book of Shadows, I wanted the person reading it to feel as if they were standing next to me, as if they were in the room with me, that they may have been, you know, they were the invisible ghost behind my, you know, right shoulder, that they were in the space with me. And I think that helped a lot. And I also had this sense of the dynamic that I had learned from Bob McKee of how to create momentum in a story by reversing the dynamic. So you would go from positive to negative. So each mm-hmm. scene would switch. So you'd have a scene that ended with an upbeat, and then the next scene would be like a crisis, and then an upbeat and then crisis. And every scene, the purpose of every scene is to give you more insight into the main character. Mm-hmm. So all the characters that they interact with, the conversations that they have, the purpose of that is for you to get to know the character better. So, you know, my choices of the scenes that I, you know, because God knows I had plenty, and Goddess knows I had plenty of countless memories. I mean, I wrote Book of Shadows like a novel, not like a typical memoir, which gave me a lot of headaches, but also gave me a lot of freedom. And then my choice, like, which conversations am I going to use? Like you were talking about, you know, the theme, like what is the connective through line in your collection of essays in the book that you're putting together now? What holds, what's the gopher that holds them all together? Is it the gopher? It was a gopher. What's the gopher that holds it all together? The gopher, I think, that holds things together in a novel, or the way I wrote Book of Shadows, is the transformation of the main character. What is the journey that they go on? Who are they at the beginning? What changes them? And who do they become at the end? And so at the beginning of the book, I was who I was. I was a hyper-rational, skeptical, union workers' rights lawyer in New York City, hyper intellectual, and you know, thinking that the that the world, you know, that the way you make your way forward in the world is through what's going on the outside. And by the end of the book, it's like, oh, I've discovered a whole internal world, and that world is full of magic and spirit and dimensions of reality that I never knew existed, which now I know exist. And it turns out that all the things I thought were bad, right, a witch, are good. And all the things I thought were good, like to be this big shot entertainment lawyer in New York with all these glamorous clients and stuff, that's actually the dark side, you know? So everything flips. By the end of the book, I've changed radically, and what's good has changed radically. And I think that was one of the reasons. I mean, it was an international bestseller, and I think that was one of the reasons why, because you come along with me on this journey, and you discover that everything we thought about witchcraft was wrong, you know, and that all the truths about witchcraft challenge all the things we think are good about the world that we live in. And it was validating for people who read it. People found it or were given it, discovered it, came across it. And I mean, in a way, it's hard for me to believe, but I can't tell you how many people have written or told me that it was the book that changed their life, because it was the book that confirmed for them that the dream they had that came true, that that was a real experience, that the longing that they had since they were a child, to know that the sense that the world, especially the natural world, was alive, that that was real, you know, that magic was a true dimension of reality that we could access and participate in, that it validated these intuitions, these instincts, these experiences that especially women had had, but that the culture said it was not true and in fact was evil. And to have that kind of confirmation, especially 25 years ago, I mean, now, you know, every time I'm Dick and Harriet, they are all witches. And that was not the case 40 years ago. I mean, not in a million frickin' years. You know, we all knew who we were. There were maybe a couple hundred people across the entire United States, and we all knew who we were. And almost everybody was in the broom closet. You know? Lena was out. I was out. Immediately, Margot Adler was out. Starhawk was out, but Starhawk was Starhawk. She was not out. If she'd been Miriam Goldstein or whatever her last name was, then she would have been out. But she was Starhawk. So who the hell was, you know, she was, right? She had a thing between her and being out. Sorry, not to criticize, but there's a difference between the name that you use as a lawyer and the name that you use as an NPR reporter, and that you're, you know, Phyllis Kiard is a witch. That's different. So that was a different world. But writing that book was, I think helped to create the world that we're in now, where every, you know, like this 8 billion views on TikTok, and there are Instagram witches, and there's this world of publishing that didn't exist, you know. And even if a lot of it is a Xerox copy of a Xerox copy of patriarchal mechanistic, you know, set your intention and screw your will to the sticking point and just law of attraction with a pointy hat. That's okay. You know, start where you are. And if you stick to the path, if you work it, it'll work, and it'll surprise you in where you end up. Writing is magic. Writing is magic. Words are magic. And
I actually have a question for you, because I agree with you, writing is magic. But, and I know you said earlier that you set a routine to where every day at 9 a.m. you made sure that you were writing, and then you would stop for lunch and then continue on for a while. Did you ever, or do you now, do any sort of magic before or after you write? Or if you're having like writer's block or issues with a certain section of the book? Do you do anything magical to help you break through that block? Because I'll be honest, I do. I'll do manifestation work, or I'll do visualization, or I will lay on my exercise ball that I'm currently sitting on my back and stare at the ceiling and rock back and forth until an idea gets knocked into my brain. Because that, to me, is magic. Movement is magic.
I think you use whatever works for you. I mean, the older I've gotten, you know, the simpler and the more profound my magic has become. And the gift that I was given to help get me out of the writer's block and the hole that I was in, and the prolonged depression after coming to terms with the damage to the planet and all that stuff, was the trees talking to me and showing me what's going on when I'm breathing, that we're, and in fact, that we're breathing together. And I was like, wait a minute, you mean all that like flaming blue pentagram with the I summon, stir, and call you up, mighty ones, and the wand had to be made out of this particular kind of wood, and, you know, and the visualization and all the machinations and the incense and all this stuff, all that was to get here? And they were like, yeah, well, you humans here, you know, you need all that shit. But basically, yeah, it was just to get you here so you would realize that the whole magic of air is that we're breathing together and that we're bound together in this holy reciprocal relationship where there is no waste. Please stop doing that when you go, which is what I was taught, right? Like, exhale your garbage and exhale your tension and then breathe in the clean, pure prana. That's how I was taught, right? It's like, no, stop. Please don't do that anymore. There's no waste. Your body is creating the breath of life for us. And when you exhale, you are bestowing upon us the gift of life. And that is how we receive it from you. And we create oxygen, which is the breath of life for you. And when we exhale it, we are blessing you with it. Please breathe with us. That's my magic now, right? Is to be as much as I can attentive to this natural magic that we're enmeshed in, all of which is organized to sustain us and help us and support us and love us and nurture us. And that instinctively, you know, most living creatures know how to live in harmony with in order to be healthy and be happy. And it turns out that when they act according to their instinct, their innate nature, that holy sacred DNA blueprint inside of them, and they behave in the ways that make them healthy and happy, even those things that we, you know, even the what, you know, those that what the, you know, having that, I'm having a senior moment. The what we were talking,
the leeches.
Even the leeches are, you know, behaving in a way to make themselves healthy and happy, and and actually can have a beneficial effect for us. The net result of that organic, natural magic of how to live properly and in harmony is that they make the world a better place for all life. They create healthy soil. They create healthy water, they create healthy temperature, healthy everything, right? Only we're the ones completely freaking out of sync. So to write, you know, it's breath and it's fire, it's spirit, it's joy. More than, it's a certain amount of courage, but it's joy. And water is, you know, to drink and to open my heart, and earth is to act, you know, to create something. But for me, the greatest struggle is with myself, with my own self-doubt, that I will not be good enough to accomplish the task, which is why I put off this book and put off this book, because this book is the most important in a certain sense and the thing that I made this commitment. But I think I'm ready. I lived it. It went from being an epiphany and a download now to something that I feel like I know to be true, which is the power of Book of Shadows, is the power of being in community, of being around the fire and telling those stories is that we affirm for each other the truth of magic, the truth of the presence of ancestors, the truth of the practices that we use that get the blindfold off so we can see these dimensions of reality that we're otherwise oblivious to. So there are, you know, there are, I mean, my whole office is magic. You know, it's full of my books and statues and my chalice and my silver goddess bowl, and it's all behind me. This is my altar. You know, it's full of all my books and everything. Not everything by any means, but a selection of the more recent, you know, the first and the most recent. And there's the goddess, and there's the stag, you know, of the season. And there's the giant poster of the pilgrim from the tarot deck. I mean, and there's my drum. So I'm surrounded by my magic, and that helps. To invoke the muse is helpful. To ask her to, the War of Art, is that what it's called? It's a wonderful little book. It's very male, but it's a wonderful little book.
The Art of War, the.
No, not the Art of War, the War of Art. It's a little tiny book by a writer, and it's this very warrior energy. It's very male, but he gets towards the end. It's no longer the warrior, because he starts to talk about invoking the muse, and he uses the section, I think, from Homer at the beginning of the Iliad or the Odyssey, where the muse is invoked.
Oh, wow.
And he talks about that ultimately we are in service to this sacred presence that will bless us and whisper to us and guide us and tell us what we need to know and how we should say it, but only if we are humble in her or his presence, right? And we understand that it is they who are, that we're serving, right? It gets very mystical. I mean, it's like all this like macho stuff. And then suddenly he starts talking about in the book. And I'm like, yo, dude, you know, she touched you. You're a pagan. Who knew? It's a wonderful book. It's a great little book. So to start, and he talks about how he starts, and he'll start by reading the invocation of the muse before he begins to write. And I did that when I wrote Spells for Living Well, because I had no time to write it. I had to write it really fast. And I was like, oh, this is beyond me. And so I began by invoking the muse. And when we did the Parliament online in 2021, I asked Mina Savari, the actress from American Beauty, who is one of my students, if she would begin the Parliament by invoking the muse. And she did, and it was beautiful. She did a filmed piece down by the water in this Grecian kind of dress. It was spectacular. So I think you have to figure out who your muse is and how you want to supplicate to them and invite them into your work. And if you do that, they will come. I mean, when I wrote the text for the deck, that's, I wrote it, but something was writing with me the whole time, especially the visionary portions, but even the camera, which is a different voice, there was a presence that was with me throughout. And part of how I know that is that the deck is far more benevolent and compassionate than I am. Misanthrope. And which is an interesting thing for a spiritual person, but I, you know, I'm also a New Yorker, but there was a presence with me throughout, you know? And so
I'm really glad that you talk about the muse that way, because a lot of people think that they have to sit and wait for the muse to show up, but it's actually the other way around. You have to show up for the muse, and you have to be there consistently to work with them to create this thing. And that was something that I've learned along my journey to writing, is to call that muse to me And it doesn't even have to be anything fancy. You just have to show up every day.
Right. Discipline.
And do it.
That's right. And people who write know this, that a huge amount of writing is work, right? Mm-hmm. You want to write it well. You want it to, you want to be succinct and to the point and well-written. It's work. The muse will, if you're blessed, the muse will show up 10% of the time. And you know it when they're there, right? Mm-hmm. Suddenly, things get very numinous and you're suddenly speaking in this extraordinary, right? There's this moment, but that won't happen. If you wait for that to start writing, that's bad magic. That's bad process.
Or doing anything creative, not just writing.
You have to show up. And if you show up and you show up and you show up, then they reward you with a jewel. With something magical. I wrote a scene in the second memoir, The Love Spell, which was fiction. And I remembered, this reality, but I didn't want to write about that. But I wanted to capture the essence of it. And so I started to write a different scene to make the point. And all of a sudden, it took on a life of its own, which a lot of writers will tell you, right, or painters, that it took on a life, it absolutely took on a life of its own, and it resolved in utter, profound magic. It was just about peeling an orange and having this conversation with this older teacher, who was basically me talking to my younger self, and we were sitting in the Washington Square Park and peeling this orange, and the conversation goes forward. And the end is that I peeled this orange and peeled away the problem. And she said, you can use anything, and you can use absolutely anything to make magic. The point of the magic, right, is the awakening of your consciousness. And anything will do that if you interact with it properly. A paintbrush, a typewriter, a computer, an animal, the trees that taught me how to breathe properly. It's all about listening. And that wasn't the intention of the scene when I started to write it, but that was where it went. And it was that, and it was like, holy fuck, that came from something else. That didn't come from me. That wasn't conscious. I didn't plan it. I had a very different intention. That's why I love all this stuff with people that are like, maybe I shouldn't have cursed. Sorry.
Oh no, you can say whatever the fuck you want.
Yeah, we're an explicit podcast. You're solid.
All these young people are focused on magic is the setting of your intention to, manipulate and control unseen forces in order to manifest your desire. I'm like, nope. You could start out that way, and intention can be very useful. And sometimes, I've got a goal, but usually, the magic is much bigger than me. I have found that usually most people, myself included, we set our goals a little too small. The magic is much bigger than our intention. And if you got to leave room for it, like what happened with you, with your ritual yesterday, whatever your intention mm-hmm. was, there was something much bigger going on, which is why you're so tired now.
Yeah. Yeah, something big definitely did happen yesterday.
Yeah, you got to leave room for it.
Yeah.
Whether you're writing or you're casting a circle or whatever. And then I have my minor magic, which is that never, after you start, never face a blank page ever, ever again. I always start. This is the only editing I allow myself when I'm writing. I always start with the last paragraph of the page I wrote the day before.
That's a nice idea. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Actually,
and then I keep going, and then I'm in.
Yep, I actually do the same thing. I will stop in the middle of a scene, and then the following day pick it up in the middle of that scene. That way I know I have something to write, yeah, instead of starting at the next chapter.
Yeah,
Yeah. I even do the same thing with journaling to a degree. Like I've horrified people before by buying a new journal. And the first thing I'll do is write something on the inside cover because I can't take that out. And the book is forever written in. So mm-hmm. that prevents me from having that blank book that I'm afraid to ruin.
Of all these beautiful leather-bound books and velvet-covered books. I've accumulated over the years, and I'm like terrified to go horrible handwriting. You know? Ah, there's the book.
Yeah, you scribble your name on the inside cover, and that's you've got no choice but to get into with that journal then. So
you're committed.
That's right.
Yep.
Yeah. Writing is magic. Writing is magic. Writing is magic. Writing is magic. Yeah, you start with a plan. People are different. Some people outline like really, really, really precisely. And I don't. I'm just like, I have a general outline and then I write my way to the book, which requires time then to go back and edit and move things around. So I have to leave a little more time in the editing process. But I feel like that if I over plan it, I may miss the point.
Yeah.
It's also an adventure. Writing is a great adventure. So
there's a lot of writers that say they don't know where the plot's ever taken them. They have a rough idea, but the characters tell them what happens. So
yeah, but a lot of people think the plot is what happens in the story, but really the plot is the journey that the character goes through. What happens to the characters is just what makes the character change. So whatever happens in the story can be anything that fits within the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can fight dragons or you can talk to a little girl on the side of the street and give her some coins. You know, both of those require character development, but the real story is the development of the character and how they change from the reaction to their exterior world in the beginning to their reaction to the exterior world and internal world at the end.
That really is. That's the plot. Yeah, right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of
that's the plot.
It's kind of the same with us, though, as people and as practitioners. I mean, if you set out with the goal of becoming the biggest, baddest witch on the block with the most Instagram followers or something like that, that's going to be a pretty dull book of life. It really is what happens to you along the way. You know, how we change as people, what hardships we go through, what, you know, what areas we make more complex, where an outside observer might go, oh my God, why is that character doing that? And what other areas do we simplify? I mean, that's the real interesting part. It actually even kind of occurs to me as you were talking about it a little bit, both of you, a lot of times with the character arcs, it's, they start off in a certain situation, they're confronted by stuff, and even in witchcraft, young practitioners really obsessed a lot of times with the possessions and with the doing things the exact same right way and standing out and that sort of thing. And as we mature as practitioners, a lot of times we simplify our practices, get down to the things that really matter, really try to connect to stuff. And I'm wondering, like, are we seeing the same thing kind of on a society level right now? Like, are we at that point where we're reaching that peak of being really consumed with consumerism and stuff? Are we ready to start gliding down that slope of simplifying and reconnecting, that sort of thing? Did the pandemic maybe make us kind of reach that peak? And you know, of course, there's going to be a lot of turmoil right now as we turn the page. But are we all kind of collectively heading in that direction? This was just my thoughts musing as I was listening to you all.
Interesting question. I don't know.
We can hope, right?
I don't know. I mean, to me, the pressing issue is not. It was a lot of. I mean, consumerism is like such a symptom of of our disembodiment and our need to have, you know, but I and our dispiritedness, but. Not to go back to it, not to loop back to it, but to me, the real crisis right now, the existential crisis is whether we're going to get through this, what's going to happen in this next period with this impulse towards fascism. It seems to be something that besets the human condition that every, you know, 100 years, 75 years, somewhere in mm-hmm. that, right, there's this rising up of this impulse, this murderous kind of psychotic impulse that we have. the need, you know, for domination and war and violence. And then, you know, we go through it and we murder each other, like, you know, and slaughter each other. And then we come out of it, and we go, oh, my God, what was that all about? Oh, we must never do that again. Okay, let's create nations. Oh, what was that? Let's create the UN. Oh, God knows what's going to be on this. And of course, the difference now between these previous paroxysms is the environmental crisis. We don't have time for this bullshit right now.
That's true.
We need to get off of all the consumerism, and we need to simplify and all that. But this thing. As situations get more complex, right? The violence seems also always to arise in these situations of acute stress, right? The plague, the this, the that there's some sort of crisis that's going on and big cultural shift that goes on that a lot of people find frightening. And there's this reaction. And we keep repeating the dynamic. I mean, I don't know. Tribal cultures, were they better? Not all of them. You know, some of them were pretty bloodthirsty, but they didn't seem to have quite this penchant for self-immolation that overtakes us periodically. That's the thing I worry about right now. I'm worried of where we're going, and the anger and the rage that's percolating to the surface, and always what happens when that's allowed, when it's, you know, which wolf is it going to be? It depends on which one you feed. Well, we've been, you know, there are a lot of people feeding this very base, disturbed part of our psyche that does tremendous damage when it's given license and it's being fed. So I'd like to believe, you know, the American public is, because it's so diverse, that it, you know, that it comes from all over the world, because we are immigrants. And there's something about this land that's so deep and holy and sacred. The spirits here are so, not special, but they're blessing spirits, right? I mean, all places are beautiful, blah, blah, but there's something about the American land that has been so beautifully loving of human beings and other life forms until we came and, you know, messed it all up. The land is so fertile and the climate has been so temperate. You know, it is a place that is almost paradisical for human beings, certainly for the other creatures that lived here. So I think what we need is inside of us, and I think it's all around us. And I'd like to think that there are enough of us, of good character and good soul, that, you know, you can push the American psyche just so far, and there'll be a point where they go, okay, and now that's enough. We're not going there. We're not gonna, you know, shoot black people. We're not gonna rape women. We're not gonna, you know, torture children. But get back under the rock. I hope. I sure hope. I don't know. Because a lot of those people think they're defending democracy.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
They really believe that. I mean, they really believe. Antifa is the bad guy.
I know it. I don't understand how that happened, other than, well, I understand, but I don't understand. You know what I mean? But
I'm determined to be as hopeful as humanly possible. I just keep breathing and calling the muse and coming to the community fire.
Yeah. Even if it's angrily to throw offerings into it, because I'm mad and upset.
Yeah.
I think, I don't know. I often point a finger at Big Brother, you know, the people over us, and I put over us in quotations because nobody really is above or below anybody else. We're all kind of on equal footing. We're basically all in the same boat. It's sinking, but I think higher ups have figured out how easily the human psyche is to control when it is dumb and afraid.
Oh yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And they use that to their power, and war makes a lot of money. And those who are in control of us currently, unfortunately, are more in line with their own pockets than they are with their communities. And like our earlier conversation with the unions, I hope this momentum continues, you know, and I hope people's communities continue to grow outside of their own households, and that they become friends with their neighbors, or they become friends with communities near them that have similar tastes and interests as they do. And that hope returns. Hope is there, but I hope it gets stronger and it gets fed, and people learn how to educate themselves and learn that fear is just an emotion. It's not who you are. You can work within fear, and you can work with fear, but you cannot work if it's controlling you.
That's, and fear is being used and manipulated. It's being, you know, exploited. Mm-hmm. I was talking with my wonderful, wonderful husband earlier, and he was watching Fox, and then he was listening to someone, I think on PBS, observing, and he said, I just switched off the channel, and they described what I was watching, that if you turn on Fox, you're going to see violence. You're going to see, you know, violence, 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 in the culture, and images that evoke violence, that look like violence, right? And it's deliberate. You know, it's deliberate. It's to scare people. It's to make them very afraid. So they, you know, they look at San Francisco and they think, you know, they're or like Portland, right? That the whole city is on fire, and there are mobs raging in the streets. But they portray this and portray this and portray this. And part of that tills the soil for the seed of fascism, because if people are afraid, the strong man shows up, right? And he comes with the troops, and he's like, I'm going to put this disorder down, and I'm going to reestablish, you know, order and peace. And I'm going to put an end to this. And they buy it. They buy it. So it has a purpose.
And it's going to make the trains run on time.
Yeah. Yeah, there's still statues of Mussolini. When you go to Italy, there are little statues.
I know it.
Mussolini and all those little souvenir shops. And now there's a fascist prime minister, a woman who's the daughter of the post Second World War fascist party. She's the prime minister in Italy. It's freaking mind blowing. It really is.
It really is.
Yeah. So, okay. So we've been asleep, you know, we got to wake up and we got to pay attention. And, you know, you got to go to the school board meeting, and, you know, you got to run for office, and because they are, you know,
yeah,
they're hard.
Yeah. They're taking over school boards and everything else. Yeah.
Yeah. So my own feeling is that when you fight back, even if you're afraid, that the reward you get is courage. Right. And it's the passivity that makes me feel afraid. I mean, that's why I spent over a year and a half working on this parliament, right? It was like, that's where I am. That's where I can plant my flag. That's where, you know, I can organize this event. It's not, you know, huge. It's not going to change everything, but there are going to be thousands of people who will come. There'll be all these religious leaders. You know, we're going to take a stand, and I can do that. I can persuade the board. I did. I can help pick the speakers. I did. I can help shape the programs. I did. You know, I'm okay. This is where I am. So This was the first international convening of religious leaders standing together to say no to fascism. It didn't get enough attention, but it got attention. Okay, so that's what we each have to figure out. Where are we? You know, am I the mother of a kid in a school district that's trying to ban books? Well, then I need to get my ass to that, you know, school board meeting, and I need to say something, right? Maybe I need to run for school board. Or, you know, maybe I live in New York City and everything seems fine. But I have a parent who does nothing but watch Fox. So I'm going to have to go visit them more often and change the channel. We got to figure out where we are and do what we can do. You got to do what you can do where you are.
I think it's important to remember that what we're saying is you don't have to organize a huge event to change people. Even if you just awaken one other person, you're doing your job. You're doing what you can. If you can do more, then do more, you know. But we need people to wake up, you know. It's the, like you were talking about earlier, the climate crisis should be our primary focus. We are literally killing the thing that is keeping us alive. Mm-hmm. At an alarming speed. And this isn't something new. This isn't something that happened, you know, within the last 5 years. This has been known since the 60s and earlier. You know, they have known this has been happening. And they've tried to get them to change and stop and find a better way. And what did they do? They cut funding to all of that research. They swept the rug out from underneath them and said, nope, we don't want to do that. Because this is what makes us money.
And was it Chevy? Chevy had an electric car back in the 70s, and they sold mm-hmm. them to the Chinese.
Yeah.
That was rocket science. And look who's the richest man in the world now, you know, this right wing nut job who's got an electric, right? He's making a million electric cars every 6 months.
If you want to know exactly where you can make a difference, sometimes it's as easy as looking at the enemy's playbook. I mean, I'm assuming you guys have all heard of, at least by this point, the Project 2025.
Yep. You don't make a manifesto like that unless you're fucking desperate.
Yep. Yeah, it's this whole big manifesto on exactly what changes they want to make and how they'd make them. And it's got notes on how to organize on every level. And that's exactly what the fascists want to do. That's their exact policy. So you know exactly how things are going to go.
Yeah.
They've laid it out for you. It's like Mein Kampf. It's there. Mm-hmm. It's right in front of your face.
When they tell you who they are, you need to believe them.
Exactly.
It's been an interesting thing to watch, to see how the media has responded to this situation. And the difficulty they've had in doing a proper analysis of fascism, right? And they're mm-hmm. still having trouble using the language. It's been really hard for them. They didn't recognize it. And they're talking about how they're once again doing with Trump what they did the last time, where they're doing this false equivalency kind of stuff.
And yeah, so yeah.
Focusing on the fact that he is an authoritarian and he's right. told what he's planning to do. And that's your news coverage. That's yep. what you cover. You know?
I don't give two fucks about Hunter Biden's laptop.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. And yet, right? Mm. So it's up to us. We gotta carry the ball across the finish line. It's tough. I mean, my husband has dear friends who are really conservative. I mean, one of them actually said, he's got pictures of Melania up on his refrigerator. I'm like, oh, yeah, yeah. And he actually said, well, if we have to have a dictator, at least it'll be Trump. He's like,
what?
What are you talking about, right? That's how far it's a real lesson in propaganda, right? In the efficacy of propaganda. And
we have to have it. Who said we have to have a dictator? Wait a minute.
At what point did the right in this country go from being anti-Russian to being pro-Russian?
I know it. Well, we've got to follow the money trail on that one, I think, is pretty easily.
Fascinating, right? Well, it shows you also how easy, you said it before, how easy it is to manipulate people.
Mm-hmm.
Right? How gullible they are. That you know, that in the span of a very short amount of time, you can take them from being totally anti-communist, air quotes, to being, you know, adoring Putin and thinking, well, sure, you know. Because the impulse is the fascist impulse. It's the attraction to the strong man. That's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And the Republican Party, this is not the Republican Party of even 10 years ago, but the Republican Party of 50 years ago and 40 years ago and 30 years, 20, they laid the foundation for this. Newt Gingrich, you know, with his the demonizing of the Democratic Party and the destruction of trade unions and the lying and the language and all the stuff. They laid the foundation for this. They just didn't think that it was going to be Trump that was going to take, you know, get to play the final hand. So we all have a lot of work to do. And witches and pagans and, you know, whatever we call ourselves, mm-hmm. we really need to be like right up front in our activism because, you know, we may not be first on the list, but we're on that list. You know, first they'll come.
I think if folks are at all confused about whether or not they are on the proverbial list, they only need to know what's happening in Pennsylvania at this point, because the intimidation tactics that we're seeing the opening salvos of are going to get worse.
Mm-hmm.
Because people who do not feel empowered to do this kind of shit don't try to resurrect dead laws to bash on minority religions.
Yeah.
So this is something to pay really fucking close attention to. And please, for the love of the gods, do not call the folks that work at the Serpent's Key in any way, shape, or form as overreacting, because these laws have been on the books for nearly, I want to say, 50 to 100 years, and they've only recently come back out of the shadows to be used again. And this is a police chief. This isn't a prosecutor. This isn't an AG. This is a police chief using the law to intimidate people.
I saw a quick Instagram post that he showed up, but then he did not come back. That was yesterday. I don't know what the situation, I mean, you know, this is the kind of thing that can change day to day. She needs to call the ACLU. She needs to call the ACLU.
Mm-hmm.
Or she can call me.
Well, I think that's so much of why, you know, you were talking about people, we need to get involved. And I don't expect anyone, including myself, to be the one person that changes the whole world, because that's not how it works. But like, even if you go down and try to get on your local school board, I mean, you can do so much with zoning laws. Look at how they use zoning laws as an effective weapon against minority religions. Zoning laws, you've got water boards, you've got groups that are, you know, government agencies that oversee pollution. You've got, you know, in our town, we've got an interfaith shelter. In their mind, interfaith tends to mean the different Christian denominations, because no other group shows up ever to make huge, you know, larger donations. This all adds mm-hmm. up. It all contributes. And that's the only way we're going to make it through this into a future that we want to see, is by all taking our own little, you know, mm-hmm. our own little grain of sand. If we each move a grain of sand, we'll move the whole beach, kind of thing.
Yeah. I want to really, if you don't mind, I really want to call leftists out on their anti-electoralism or shit for this, because the fact of the matter is that, yes, we are living under a system where the popular vote is not always who chooses our president, because we are living with an antiquated system with an electoral college that picks our president at the end of the day, no matter what the popular fucking vote is. I get that. And that is the key critique that I will agree with fellow leftists on. The problem comes is when electoralism in general is thrown out as the baby with the bathwater, because it is harm reduction. And people will on the left gripe about, well, harm reduction isn't good enough. Okay, well, unless you are the motherfucker that's going to start the armed revolution and make all this magic happen, where suddenly, poof, we're going to have all these supply lines and we're going to be able to do all this revolutionary shit you think. which to me, every time somebody brings up the Glorious Revolution, it smacks of millenarism, no different than the Rapture.
Yeah.
So I want to completely put that aside in leftist circles. The millenarian thinking isn't helping us. You know, there is no Glorious Revolution that's coming. You're here, you're now, this is what you can do where you live. This is the tools you have at your disposal. And yes, the tools will never dismantle the master's house, but you can't burn down the fucking house with everybody still in it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I want reform. I don't want a revolution. You know, it is appealing sometimes, don't get me wrong, but revolutions are bloody with a lot of people, a lot of innocent people crushed under the wheels of that change. I don't exactly want that. I want reform. I want strong and deep and meaningful reform.
You remember the Who? Meet the new boss, same as the old boss? I mean,
yeah, exactly.
The only place where a revolution actually made a difference was here, and that's because they created a democracy. So, you know, and this is the worry about the third party candidates. Like, you can't run a third party in the midst of dealing with
the political apparatus has no place for it.
Say again?
The political apparatus, as we have it in this country, has no place for a third party. And the only reason that bull moose tactic worked is because of the existential threat that was presented to the parties at the time. And we don't have that kind of candidate. We don't have that kind of groundswell right now. We just don't. We don't have time to fuck around. And moreover, you know what? Say what you will about Democrats. I'm fine. I have been a lifelong Democrat who is an eco-socialist. Okay. I get it. I get being disappointed in the Democrats. Okay.
They make me angry all the time.
They piss me off continuously. They disappoint me a lot.
Yep.
But look at my fucking state of Michigan. Okay. When the Democrats got back in charge, our unions got their fucking rights back. We have had so many good policies that have come through. Now, we've had some stinkers, don't get me wrong, because the stripping out of the insurance policies here has been a fucking disaster. It has been an absolute god-awful disaster. Whitmer never should have signed it, period. But there is a big fucking difference between fascists, which is what the Republican Party are at this point, and if you're voting for them, you're either completely fooling yourself, in which case you're a fool, or you are hook, line, and sinker, you're into fascism at this point, and you're not to be fucking trusted. And I don't care what your religious affiliation is at this point. If you're voting for a Republican, you're voting for people to die. Period. End of sentence. So what are we left with? We have the Democrats and we have the Greens. And the Greens have always been spoiler candidates. We don't have the infrastructure at the moment to support a Green candidate. And they're not big enough. And the Republicans aren't fractured enough to make them viable. So what the fuck are you going to do besides spoil the Democrat candidate by voting for the other guy?
That's right. That's right. When you're dealing with a fascist that is polling as high as Trump is, there's no room for a third party candidate. Not right now.
We've seen this happen, though. We've seen this exact scenario. This is how the NSDAP first got power, because it split the leftist voter base. The reaction to the NSDAP in the parliament of the time, when Germany was going through their election process, split the leftists. We can't afford that shit right now. We can't. And, you know, you can believe that the electoral process is fucked all night, all day. That's great. I'm happy for you. But please, if it is a waste of your time, at least put in an absentee voter ballot or do something besides not show up.
So this is an example of, like, that's one of the things that you can do. I mean, you just put your flag where you are in the community, right? Where you have connection, where you have vocabulary, where you have the ability to engage in meaningful and persuasive conversations.
Right.
That's critical right now. That's
absolutely a
conversation that needs to be had, and it needs to be had right now because we have no time.
Well, the thing is, like, are you voting for a party or are you voting for policy? Because at the end of the day, the Republicans have shown they want to cut taxes and they want to bloat the military budget even more than what it's at right now. And the services they want to cut are vital. They want to raise voting age. They want to raise the point at which you can access retirement. benefits, and retirement in general for this country is already egregiously way too far in the future for my liking. Okay, because if we actually take a real accurate count, because our average lifespan just decreased by like 3 years. So what you're telling me is you want to increase the rate at which I can access my Social Security to 67 when the average lifespan of a person in this country is maybe 73? Like, think about that, folks. Middle age at this point is not 100, isn't the fine point between 100. It's not 50 fucking years old. It's 30. You're middle aged at 30 with the way our life expectancy in this country fucking works. And they want to raise the rate at which you can retire. Your life literally fucking depends on how you vote.
They don't want to just raise it. That's a stuff they want to get.
Oh, they want to dismantle the Social Security entirely. Like, right. That's the long term goal. But in the interim,
from the beginning,
yeah. So like,
they're passing laws now for child labor again.
Yeah. Yep.
If they told us what they plan to do. You know, it starts with the raising the age, but that's just to make it socially acceptable. You know, the plan is to do away with all of it. The plans are dark. 2025, the plans are dark. And, you know, you put Trump, if Trump gets back into power, it's very unlikely that there'll be another election period that follows. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen.
The thing that really gives me hope is not only are so many people just waking up to the scam, but that so many people are saying, well, you know what? I get that the system doesn't work. So what are we going to do? And they're looking around their local community going, you know what? Fine. Let's build something here. What can we build? You have people that are doing permaculture in Chicago on concrete fucking streets at this point that have been abandoned. You have people that are building urban agriculture in Detroit using abandoned parking lots and abandoned what used to be home lots. You have people all over this country engaging in active growing of hope. It is not a hopeless fucking situation. You just have to put your collective hands in the dirt and do something. And it can be any little thing, joining your local school board or showing up to the meetings, because they, a lot of times you can help sway the way those votes go by just showing up and saying no. And I'll blow this up on social media if you vote this way. Your presence matters. Every individual fucking person who has something that they want to do, fucking do it. And it doesn't matter how great or small it is. Grand gestures at this point are kind of empty at this juncture.
As much as she's done for voter registration, hell, at this point in time, you can sway the next election by buying a Taylor Swift album.
Well, she planted her flag where she is.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I don't know if you know what I'm referring to. She sent out an Instagram post encouraging people to register to vote, and it like swamped the registration sites for days.
Good. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, Taylor Swift is not my favorite person in the world, but I think it's all to the good. If you can get people mass interested in being part of the system, go for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think she saw the power she had by showing up to a football game and then several games thereafter sold out because of her presence there. She's like, you know what? I could be a villain or I could be a good guy. Hey, you should register to vote. And people are like, I should register to vote.
Critical. It's absolutely critical.
It's funny because like even the union meeting I went to recently, they were talking about the fact that, you know, unions are seen as pro-Democrat. And the guy giving the presentation said, we're not. We look at policies. It just so happens that one party matches a hell of a lot more policies that we agree with than the other one does.
Yep.
You know, so get involved with your union, just whatever. There's so many little steps that all of us can take. And, you know, and we just have to hope that collective action makes that difference. Because
some of
theoretically will.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Some of the most unsung fucking heroes of every social movement are the people who sat at home, took care of the kids, and made the dinners and organized the stuffed actual. Yeah. Like the only reason the truth survived to where it is because Ross, who was a longtime person who took care of, like, had multiple hats. She did that work and allowed the truth to survive multiple upheavals. The people that do the work, the Black Panther Party, the reason why they went the way they did and could get the things they got done was because the women of that movement made it possible. There wasn't a bunch of just guys showing up with guns. Now, granted, that was part of it, and that was important. But the Black Panthers' biggest threat was the fact that they were willing to fucking feed kids.
Mm-hmm.
And it requires people to just show up and cook. You don't, you know, it doesn't have to be this grandiose screaming Wolverines as you go into the Red Dawn sunset. It's easy to die. It's really hard to live and heal. This country makes it very easy to die. It's expensive to be dead, but it's easy to die.
It stuns me to realize, like, I'm a crone. How did that happen? Okay. But it wasn't that long ago that I was a maiden, you know, and a very radical one. And what I would hope is that the people who are now who I was then would listen and hear us when we say, do not sacrifice the good enough because it isn't perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Don't be such an idealist, right? And such an absolutist, right? That you won't compromise your values to vote for somebody who doesn't share 100% of them. There, I remember people saying, oh, what's the difference between Gore and Bush? There's no difference. Really, the fuck there was an enormous difference. Enormous difference. And if people had voted, you know, if people had voted for Gore, we would be in a very different world right now. Can't describe it fully, but it would certainly have been a much more environmentally sensitized and progressive world, not the one that we're in right now. And we wouldn't be dealing with imminent fascism. We wouldn't.
No.
It's not.
You can draw a clear line between the Gore v. Gush, mm-hmm. Gore v. Bush election. don't get me wrong. Like, I saw that when I was a freshman in high school when that whole thing went down. And even then, it was just like the 500 voters in Florida made the difference.
That's right. 500 votes in Florida.
Cannon Fodder on TikTok talks about this a lot because she's a teacher in Florida at the moment. And, you know, it blew my mind because I forgot that number. That was the margin of error between the Electoral College of Florida going one way or the other.
Okay. Every vote counts. Every vote counts.
They wouldn't try to strip voting rights from people if it didn't fucking matter at all.
Somebody said vote for Biden if he was a head in a jar.
He might be more entertaining that way.
He's not the candidate I would choose. But if he's the candidate we've got and he's a head in a jar, I'm pulling the lever because the alternative the alternative is a nightmare that you haven't even begun to understand.
Right.
And from which you may not be able to escape, not even in your lifetime, no matter how young you are. So I'm just like begging people not to be so idealistically stubborn that they doom us, you know, to a fascist country, to a fascist leadership, to a fascist country.
Ideals are needed. Ideals are absolutely needed and necessary, and you need to keep them well in mind when you're going to vote. You know, that ideals should guide our actions because otherwise you're just reacting, right? And that's what we're seeing the results of is reactionary politics. You know, whether you're talking about populism as a reactionary politic or whether you're talking about, you know, neoliberalism politics as usual. I feel a great deal of hope. This generation that's coming up behind mine are some of the most politically minded and involved people. And I don't mean that in the sense of they're just going to vote Democrat. I mean that when they vote, they are thinking about what they're doing and how they're doing it. Listening to my son talk about policy at age 17 has been amazing for my heart, because, well, not only is it that, you know, they've been listening to the last generation, but they're taking what we say to heart. They're thinking about it and going, okay, I see where you're coming from, and this is how I'm going to act. Yeah. There's a lot of people in the older generations, especially the boomer generation and some of the Gen X, catch a lot of shit. And I think that at least our leftist comrades need to be commended for still carrying the flag and still fighting. Because we wouldn't have the generations that are coming forward now if we didn't have that leadership. And we are coming into an era where those lessons from our ancestors, whether you're talking about the queer community listening to the elders that we have left post the AIDS epidemic, whether you're listening to the leftists in our midst who lived through the Gore v. Bush election era, you know, with the rise of the neocons. If you just listening to the last generation or two, and I have so much hope that we can still make it. And it's not like this false hope of I'm trying to just shore up my confidence that not everything's going to fall to shit. I've seen these kids in action. I've marched alongside some of them. So I do feel hope. I do feel a genuine sense that, yeah, we can pull this off if we come together. And it's based in evidence, because when they show up, they get shit done. And so when we show up together, we get shit done.
The other faction that's critical right now are women. I mean, yes. I think maybe women who save our democracy because of what happened to Roe v. Wade.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to say it, but, you know, white women are largely responsible for us not having Roe v. Wade anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were supporting some very right-wing candidates, by and large.
Yeah, and that makes me sick.
I mean,
I'm ready for the hate to come in, but I said it.
Like, it's not like white men are off the hook here either, because they're the primary voter base.
No. No, they are the primary voter base. You're absolutely right. But it was one of those things that a lot of the younger generation pointed out. You know, when I watched a lot of their social and political commentary, they pointed out that why the hell were people voting against their own rights? Didn't make any sense at all.
Oh.
Yeah. I have hope from the evidence of having spoken with and marched and worked and just been a part of different groups where these young people are present. But I'm also hopeful because of the myths. I'm also hopeful because I have never seen in my lifetime, even the last 10 years previous to this one, you know, when I first became a pagan, you know, it was a trickle of people that were getting picked up by different gods. And now it's like all hands on deck. We're getting shit done. You know, you got people who are coming forward who have shit to do, and I'm glad for it. Go ahead, brother. I'm sorry. I
think I stunned Phyllis into silence there. There was a very contemplative look on her face.
I mean, my recollection was that 50% of women voted Democrat pretty much when you look at, but that's national polling. And like 57% of white women voted Democrat. It was black women that played pivotal roles in critical states like Georgia and elsewhere. And that 50%, like 58% of men or something like that have been consistently voting Republican, you know, white males, blah, blah. And those statistics can be off, but that was my recollection of the last round that I looked at.
I don't remember the exact numbers, to be honest with you. So
people consistently vote against their own interests, and that's sort of where this conversation started, right? That, and this is the danger of propaganda, and this is the danger of what fascists do, and they understand how to manipulate fear, and they understand how to turn racial or religious or LGBTQ or pick, you know, pick your subgroup, and one at a time they get picked off as the other against whom, you know, the rage and the id gets directed. And so all hands on deck, you know, we're getting to the end of the time. And it's sort of full circle around the campfire, that all hands on deck, and don't underestimate what one person can do. You have to, but you do what you can where you are. And like you said, no, there isn't a single one of us that has the standing or the stature or the, you know, we're not Taylor Swift's with, you know, mega audience that can be moved to the ramparts 1, 2, 3. But if everybody did something where they were, what they can do where they are, and even if it's a conversation with a parent. I remember when all those kids went down to Florida to talk to their grandparents to get them for Obama. I mean, you know, you plant your flag where you are and do the best you can, and don't be afraid. And one of the things to not be afraid of, we all stopped talking. I noticed it was happening a lot during the Bush years, that people got quiet, that you didn't talk about politics, right? That you just sort of sidestepped it. And it was the beginning of this kind of weird entrenchment. And so you didn't want to get into conflicts. And now everybody needs to, you know, you need to talk. You need to talk. How we break through the wall that's been put up around people. I mean, you know, that was strategic. It's been a long time. It's been a long-term project. It's been going on for 50 years. And this is where we are now. But wherever you are, you gotta plant your flag and do what you can do. Because on the other side of this, you don't want to be saying, shit, why didn't I do something? And magic is not enough. Magic is the fuel that you run on to act in accord with your magic. You have to act in this world to make changes in this world.
Thank you for fucking saying it. Magic isn't everything. You have to have action as well.
Yep.
Yeah. If you just do magic and you don't take action, the odds are not in your favor. Your magic's going to work. You have to act in accord. That's the magic. That's the magical ingredient. In accord, you're in a body for a reason.
Yeah, if you want to use magic, do a spell for helping somebody's eyes be open or helping ease a conversation that might be particularly difficult with a parent or a grandparent or a family member or whatever. You know, do little bits of magic like that, but you have to be on the street. Your both feet planted on the ground, your flag flying whatever direction it needs to go, and you have to do something. Yeah. And it hurt so much when Roe versus Wade was overturned, to know that women willingly walked to the polls and gave up their rights, handed them right back and said, nope, I don't need this. And with the idea that our voting is, you know, under the barrel now, fucking terrifies me.
But it was also women. I mean, every place that this has been on the ballot, Kansas, Ohio,
that's true.
Wisconsin, you know, in places, right, that went Trump land, every place where there's been a vote, you know, women and men, supported by men, have made it clear. 80% of people
in the
country do not agree with what has come down. And so, you know, so whatever it takes to get you to the polls, you got to go. Whatever it takes to speak up, you got to speak. I mean, I keep saying the world needs your witches. The world needs your witches, and witches need skills. But, you know, the world needs all of us, no matter what label you're putting on yourself. We, you know.
I think If you ever sell merchandise, Phyllis, I think that's your next merch idea. The world needs witches and witches need skills. I think that's a sweatshirt.
Okay.
You could sell that.
Like, oh my God, there are all these people out there calling themselves witches and their chops are not so great.
World needs witches, and witches need skills. I think that's a slogan.
Okay, good. I'll use it. Yeah, the world needs your witches, and witches need, well, because people, right? People are calling themselves that because it's fashionable, because it's an act of rebellion, because it's a form of, you know, identity, because they think they are, because they want to be. It's all great. Whatever is floating your boat. But to call yourself a witch is to call yourself a wise one. That's what the word meant. A seer of the sacred. And for that, you need skills. You know, it was a spiritual technology. It was shamanism. The stuff works if you work it. But it's also, you know, there aren't a lot of good teachers around. So, you know, that's why I'm working so hard. I had no interest. But then I realized there are all these people. They're using the term. It's a responsibility, right? It's the it's the person in the community that you go to, you know, to understand the dream. It's the person that you go to help you have the vision quest. It's the person that you go to when you need a healing, you know, physically or psychologically or spiritually. It's the person you go to when you need magic. It's the person you go to help you get attuned to the magic that's happening all around us that, you know, we've forgotten. It's a job. It's a responsibility. And you need skills for that. You need skills for that. Also, there is a lot of polluted thinking. There's a lot of patriarchal, you know, silly stuff, you know.
Love that.
Yeah.
I think that's the name for this episode, which is also a responsibility.
It is.
I like that phrasing a lot.
I think it's time that women rule the world for a little while.
I'm good with
our turn.
I am good with that.
Exhausting.
I mean, we may not want to.
You know what? It's what Obama said, right? Why is it always a black guy that has to come out? Women. Like, why is it always us that have to come out? You know, I love my husband, but why I always have to clean up after him in the kitchen? And you know,
it's bad enough I got to wipe down the counters. Now you expect me to clean up global politics? What the hell?
All right. We'll do it.
I mean, somebody's got to do it. They're not handling it very well. And the women that are in there, unfortunately, are being controlled by the men that are also there. So, I mean, fuck it. Get rid of all those dudes. Women, let's just sit at the table for a while.
I'm just ready for more minority voices in general.
Yes, please. Yeah.
All colors.
Absolutely.
All colors.
There's a possibility. It could be a really magical, profoundly beautiful, you know, divinely guided, magnificently embodied world. It already is. The fact is, it's extraordinary. It is not without, you know, alligators.
Right.
And pandemics and, you know, but by and large, and an occasional hurricane or volcano, but by and large, the whole thing is so beautifully, brilliantly, magically wrought. We just need to get right with it. That's what the skills are for, right? Is to get right with it, to get right with the magic that already is. And we can do it.
With that, we've hit like a 2-hour mark. So I think that's probably good for a show. Is there anything else you wanted to mention real quick before we head out? I know everybody should check out your books and the anniversary of your books and the Witch's Wisdom Tarot and all that other fun stuff. Anything else in particular you're doing anytime soon?
I'm doing two things. I'm doing this massive masterclass on witchcraft to give witches skills, and we're overbooked. So I'm taking a waiting list for the next round. If people jump, we passed the limit that I put on it in less than 24 hours.
Oh,
so
amazing.
It's gotten big. And I'm super psyched. I'm a little nervous because I'm doing it online. We have people from all over the world, which is cool. It's something that I did in person for many years. So I will say, but I'm psyched. I'm really, really excited. So I'm going to do one and then I'm going to do another. And I'm going to do for the Shift Network in the spring, I'm going to do a big witchcraft thing for them. And I'm really,
oh, very awesome.
Really super, super psyched. They're doing it under the shamanism section, which also pleases me. No end, because that's
they're very good at promoting their stuff too. So yeah, I'm sure people will see it.
I hope so. So that, I mean, I'm just going to work as hard as I can to give as many people as possible good skills. And then what you do with it is up to you. Like the deity that speaks to you, you know, hopefully the skills will help you hear and see, recognize, know, you know, what's coming to you. And that magic that's out there that's designed to bless us, it'll be easier for people to hook up to it and to sustain themselves and to help sustain their communities, because they're part of this larger community of creation. Because we've got tough times coming. First the fascist thing that has to be dealt with, and then the environmental stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason that we're all here now. There's a reason that you have lit the campfire. There's a reason that we have chosen to be present in the lives that we're in the world that we're in at this moment of crisis. So here we go.
Excellent. Well, I'll make sure that we get everybody links to those things and resources, and I hope it goes smashingly successful.
I'm so excited.
That is very exciting.
A little stressed, but really. Yeah.
Really appreciate it.
You'll do great. You have a great online presence. You're fine.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, darlings. And thank you for inviting me to join you at the fire, especially now as the season of the dark and the dreaming starts. It's nice to be here with all of you.
Absolutely.
It's so great having you again.
It's wonderful to have you back.
And thank you, as always, to all our listeners, our wonderful Patreon supporters. You do so much for us, our Discord community, and share the show. It's best and easiest way that you can help us is by sharing the show and giving us good reviews. And thank you from the bottom of our hearts, and we will talk to you next time around the fire.